Greetings, listeners, and welcome to part three of our recording of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. I am joined once again by my lovely co-host, Tinashe, and we will be going through chapters 21 onwards of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. So, Tinashe, I will leave it up to you to continue the journey.
Okay, so next on my points was about the DA lesson before Christmas that they did. And so my point was about how, you know, Harry and Cho, though I love them, I honestly, you know how much I love Harry and Cho together. And then that's not even crack shipping Harry and Hermione together, with Harry and Ginny being like, honestly, if he was the only man left in the world and she was the only woman left in the world, then maybe that could happen. But anyway, I'd say that Harry and Cho were kind of doomed before they even began, particularly this year of school. But the fact that Cho was still grieving Cedric, there was no way that they were going to happen together. And yeah, it just makes me sad. Like, they couldn't even start.
That's true. Mm. I mean, obviously, their kissing scene is just so iconic by how, like, is this when Hermione does the teaspoon thing, or am I confusing that with the movie? Like, when he comes back, like when she's like the emotional range of a teaspoon. I don't know if that's maybe in the movie. I think that's a movie
line. I think that's in the movie. I can't remember. I don't think it's in
I guess it's in the movie because
I don't remember.
And then it ends with saying she was much too close. He could see every tear clinging to her eyelashes. And then he returned to the common room, whatever. And then he tells them. And then he's like, Hermione's like, did you kiss? And then he's like, it was wet because she was crying. And then Harry is sort of like, well, Ron asks, are you that bad of a kisser? And then Harry's like, I don't know, maybe. And then Hermione's like, I don't know. I mean, she's like, of course you're not. And then Ron is like, how do you know? Because he's thinking. And then
JK inserting those jealousy moments.
And then obviously Hermione's logical. She's like, well, Cho's been crying a lot, blah, 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 blah. And then obviously Hermione gives them her smart responses, which is really, really good. And she explains a little bit more about the grief and everything, like what you were talking about, and pretty much just what Cho is going through. And then, yes, the line is in here because Ron said one person can't feel all that at once, they'd explode. And then Hermione's like, just because you've got the emotional range of a teaspoon doesn't mean we all
have. Yeah. I'm glad that they kept that from the movie, because that's definitely in the movie too, right?
Definitely in the movie too. Yeah, I don't know how much it rings in the movie. I'm not sure if it's as nasty or it's more comedic. We'll have to see when we watch it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and apparently Hermione does say she might hint that she actually got her first kiss. But anyway, that's just Ron's jealousy coming into play. And I guess for me, moving away from the romance and stuff, it's sort of interesting how JK sort of uses the Christmas mood to then offset it with the Harry dream, like when he wakes up at the end. So it's like, you know, he has this horrible
dislike moment.
Yeah, but then, he just had like such a nice sort of like lead into Christmas, because they were having their last DA lesson and they were all excited. And then he got to his first kiss, and then boom, he has that horrible, well, not dream, it's an actual vision of what's going on. But yeah, I just thought that was very interesting. And I think, to add to that, there was also a Thestral's reveal, I think, because they had a lesson with Hagrid where he reveals the fact that the
that's the lesson that's before the
the courage. And I just found it interesting that was JK's like representation of like people that have grieved or whatever going through that. But what I find funny is that really all these years no one ever told these first years or whatever that these carriages are not drawn by like nothing, like nobody ever mentioned that. So what, nobody ever had a death in the family until Harry had a death in the family, and then he's like, I can see them too. But I know it's probably just obviously the context that Harry wouldn't have talked to anyone that would have had the relevance to say that. So like,
and it's not like a subject that would easily come up.
Yeah, like a Neville.
I guess it. And how they even treat those creatures, like just because they can't see them, they're viewed as dark creatures by the Ministry and possibly by some of the wizarding world.
And
yet the Ministry can work with Dementors, make it make sense.
Exactly. And I don't know if I had, but I did note if we're talking back about romance, which I feel annoyed about because I didn't talk about this then, but Ginny was a bit of a surprise talent in their DA classes. I know I'm shipping Ginny and Harry here. But she just showed her talent. And I was like, this is why book Ginny just gives me life. But I don't know what they did with her. Anyway, it's just fine. It is what it is. It's okay. It's okay.
For sure.
I know you're just heartbroken that I'm talking about your least favorite character, but whatever.
No, I think as we read the books more, Ginny is definitely featuring as one of like she's growing on me. Yeah. She's growing on me. And I feel like out of all the characters in the movie and in the books, she's the one who I'm getting to know a bit more now.
Yeah.
Because as I said before, the films were the last thing that I watched.
The frame of reference.
Interacted with with the Harry Potter world. Yeah. My next point was about the dream, of course, that Voldemort sent him. So I noted that, you know, maybe this was the way LV, that's how I have it written, Lord Voldemort was testing their connection. Yeah, LV. That's how
Louis Vuitton, are we doing brand names now?
I'll be typing and everything, my notes, right? And I'm like, Lord Voldemort takes too long to type. LV, Louis Vuitton.
At least you give him a nice, I just call him Voldy, like literally.
Oh, Voldy. Yeah,
because it rhymes with Voldy, so.
Nice. So I was talking about how Lord Voldemort was testing their connection, right? But then I wonder what he thought their connection was, because he didn't think that, or he had no idea that he was a Horcrux then.
Yeah.
So why did you think they had a connection? Now I can't remember.
Because at this point, this is when Voldemort recognizes that they have a connection. Because this particular vision makes them more connected. I would have to go back and reread. But if I'm not mistaken, before this time, Harry could just see the visions, thinking they were just visions, like as in dreams.
Yeah.
But now, especially when they then go to Dumbledore's office, Dumbledore especially was the first one to recognize this is not a dream and this guy has been literally connected, and that's where the occlumency lessons start. But at this particular point, I think Voldemort has not yet realized he can project to Harry or whatever. But then in realizing that, obviously he uses that to then get him to come to the Department of Mysteries or whatever. But I don't know why he didn't know about the Horcrux connection. But I also know that he didn't know, because in JK's writing in the later books, when she's talking about Voldemort's ego, he didn't think he could impart part of his soul to something or someone like Harry, who he looks at as beneath him or whatever. So when he died, he just looked at it as like a defeat for that moment. He didn't look at it as a defeat that also had super, super consequences. He only looked at, oh yeah, your mom saved you, whatever. But then he didn't think his Horcrux doing things was like going to bury itself in like Harry and like whatever. I feel like it was just more Voldemort's ego stopping him from being able to like accept. He might have known it, because obviously that's the problem. We don't know the villain's mindset. So he might
He thought their connection was more so because about the love thing, that when he talks about it in the grave, at the grave, in book four, that the connection between them was because and why he was defeated was Lily's sacrifice. Therefore, his blood, which is also in turn Lily's blood, was going to be able to be used to revive him, resurrect him, but also he would have that protection, therefore be able to touch Harry. I think that's what he thought their connection went, like as far as it went. I mean,
it didn't go any deeper for any other reasons and potentially soul destroying reasons. Yeah, no, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. But I also want to point out the fact that, you know, at this point, when Harry's just experienced this traumatic thing, he thinks Mr. Weasley has been beaten by Nagini. He's gone to Dumbledore. He's shaken. At this point, Dumbledore is still ignoring Harry.
Yep.
But even though he's trying to help Harry, so he's not even he was actively trying not to make eye contact with Harry. He was focusing on the instruments around the room and all that. I actually made a point. I'm like, I now understand, because I was wondering what the instruments were doing. Like, if you told me that, you know, they check up on Harry's status, like, you know, when he's at home, if he's safe. But whilst he's at Hogwarts, I think there's that emotional mind status that they report to Dumbledore, about Harry. And especially when he, like the silver instruments emit a smoke and they form a serpent's head. And then he says, but in essence, are they divided? And then the serpent divides into two, meaning Harry and Voldemort are not one person. Like
it's the soul of, it's a fragment.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially that's the St. Mungo's chapter now, like in terms of chapter 22, because that's when he officially goes to Dumbledore's office. So
yeah,
that definitely is an interesting chapter. Just you get a bit more of, like, obviously we see Dumbledore's chapter in office in the previous chapters, I mean books, sorry, but at this stage now we're getting a sense of what he does when he's in that office, like you're saying, track of Harry, the way he's keeping track of a lot of, like, there's a lot of plates spinning in Dumbledore's office, essentially, like, as in we get a sense of he's communicating with the headmasters. We now understand what those portraits on the wall mean. He's actually literally, headmasters are beholden to be loyal to the current sitting headmaster.
We see glimpses of that in some of the books, but not to that extent.
But in this instance now, we get a connection of Phineas, Nigellus, whatever, Black's portrait, like talking to, you know, Dumbledore.
Say his name again. What? The one that starts with the
Nigellus.
I felt like you.
Nigellus. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know how to pronounce this Latin or Italian or whatever names.
Look, I don't know either. Up. But I'm like, hey, is she saying the N-word?
I'm not saying the N-word. I wouldn't be. I'll tell you a funny anecdote. Just remind me at the end. I have a funny little anecdote to tell you about that. Just as a reminder to everybody, we're Black, so we're not saying anything. We're all right.
It's like people saying, it's okay, I can say it, I've got Black friends.
No. But I'm just saying, if we were to address it to someone, and they'll be like, wait, what? What were they now talking about? No. It's just a little, you know, side note there. But, so I don't know if you had finished with your point. Sorry, I just was connecting to say like that.
I think I was actually going to move on before they got to St. Mungo's when they're still at, because when they leave when Harry leaves Dumbledore's office, they go to Grimmauld Place. Yeah, that was my next point.
But
yeah.
I was going to, before we even get there then, I actually had some point. I was going to say on my little sticky notes, what is happening to Harry, like you said, when he goes to Dumbledore and Dumbledore is still not connecting to him? It's a good example of, like, when you withhold information. Harry is suffering because Dumbledore is not telling him the whole plan. Perfectly not telling him the whole plan. And
it's the protecting your love. Not that he was. Did he love Harry?
He liked Harry, I think.
He now loved him like a family member, I think, at that point in time. But is that protecting your loved one? By not telling them that they're in danger.
Exactly.
And I hate that trope. I hate it.
And it's really frustrating because Dumbledore, like, he's the puppet master, right? Like, he's got the dots connecting. Voldemort is here, Snape's there, Harry's there, everybody else is around that chessboard. And he's full on, like, Queen's Gambit style, trying to get things going. But he's forgetting. And that's why I love at the end when he talks about the fact that he didn't account for Harry being a human being that he was going to care about. Harry was just a weapon, and that's it. And that's sad to think about, but that's what he admitted. And so for me, like, when Dumbledore not giving him enough information, the isolation Harry feels, like, the fact that they leave that school without Harry understanding what is going on, it literally makes that whole chapter of him being at home. He literally wants to leave the Weasley's house because he's like, I'm going to endanger them. And then Phineas whatever is like, where do you think you're going? You know, like, Dumbledore obviously kept you. I know there's a follow-up where I think I pointed this out, when he's about to leave, Phineas in some ways does remind him that you are kind of a bit entitled in your attitude to think that Dumbledore should tell you everything. But in a way, he's a teenager. What is he supposed to think? Like, what do teenagers think? They think that they're the center of the universe, right? So expecting Harry to be like thinking in a mature way is just too much of an expectation.
And he's 15 at this point, isn't he? Yeah.
And also, even the way that, because in some ways I'm like that, right? When I get a concept or a theory, I can't explain it to someone. I can't dumb it down for someone. I don't know why, but Dumbledore embodies that so perfectly, in the sense that when he understands something and he gets to the conclusion, he will then find his own way to tell you about it, but in sort of like very entitled to the information. Like he's like, oh, okay, I've got the information. I'll tell you when I'm ready. You just have to wait until I'm ready. And I'm like,
thank you, Dumbledore.
I'm not Dumbledore. I'm not saying I'm that bad, but it reminds me of, oh my God, no way. I am no Dumbledore level of like machinations and like all the stuff that he does. It's just, yeah.
Did you claim that you were Slytherin?
No, my chest almost always come out Gryffindor, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I wish I was a Slytherin, but yeah, but also Snape, that moment when like he looks at Dumbledore and like he feels like the snake wanting to strike kind of thing. That is what I was talking about. That's when Voldemort fully feels the connection with Harry.
Yes.
And he feels could actually attack Dumbledore through Harry.
Yeah.
And that's why Dumbledore was afraid of like connecting with Harry, because he was like, you can be like a potential spy. And I'm like, well, Mr. Dumbledore, you're a smart man. You couldn't have figured out other ways to like...
And that fits into the what happens later when Moody and Mrs. Weasley are talking about how Harry is possessed. But I'll let you finish your point.
Oh, you know, I was done. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So what you're saying, like, it fits into how then Harry starts thinking that he's possessed. I think this thought's already starting, and then Moody and Mrs. Weasley's conversation just confirms it. So on page 434, it's like, so Potter says he saw it all happen. Yes, said Mrs. Weasley. She sounded rather uneasy. You know, Dumbledore seems almost as if he's been waiting for Harry to see something like this. Yeah, well, said Moody, there's something funny about the Potter kid. We all know that. The fact that the people around him are saying these things.
This is when they're in the hospital, right?
No, this is before they go. Oh, okay. Is this when they're at the hospital?
Because at the hospital, he overhears them talking. That's the only time.
It's when they're at the hospital. Time. Yes.
Yeah.
And then blah, blah, blah. The boys, this is Moody. The boys seeing things from inside, you know, who's snake. Obviously, Potter doesn't realize what that means. But if you know who is possessing him, Harry pulled the extendable ears out of his own ear. He is at hammering very fast and he's rushing up to his face. He looked around at the others. They're all staring at him. The strings still trailing, blah, blah, blah. So just thinking about how at this point in time, as you say, he feels like he essentially... He is Voldemort's instrument.
Yep, he does.
Of destruction at this point.
He does.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's understandable why he would want to leave.
Definitely. But for me, a little shout outs because...
And sorry, there was a point like in the following, in the next chapter, because I don't know why it's not at the bottom of that other chapter, but it's like, was this why Dumbledore would no longer meet Harry's eyes? Did he expect to see Voldemort staring out of them? Yeah, if for a 15-year-old, that's
true.
That's heavy.
I mean, hey, he's just heard that you know who might be possessing him. So what can he think? But for me, shout outs in that St. Mungo's chapter was, first of all, getting to finally see what St. Mungo's is all about, because we get references of it in other books, but we finally see how they get there. I just kind of love how quirky JKR makes her world. Like, because obviously you could just easily replicate a Muggle hospital setup, but it's like a Muggle hospital, but with its own little quirks. And even in that chapter, we get the drop of a hint of what's going to come, because I think they meet, I think it's maybe in the next chapter, but there's a character that is referenced getting a vine, whatever, and then find out that vine kills them. Yes. So like little drops like that. And I think there was also a mention, I like how Miss Weasley, there's a point when Harry hesitates to go into the room to see Mr. Weasley, and Mrs. Weasley just like drags him along as family kind of thing. So even in all this, there's still like Miss Weasley being the mother that we love her to be. I was going to say that we expect her to be, but no, she doesn't have to be like that to Harry. But she's motherly towards him, even in moments of distress, even when he thinks he doesn't deserve her motherliness, because her husband just literally got attacked by what Harry thinks he did, but she's still like very, So I really enjoyed sort of that ebb and flow, because especially the tension, I can only imagine, I think in the movie they captured a little bit, but it's not really as well done. It doesn't extend as well as you reading about it, but they capture that like sort of like anxiety that they have. So I want to see what in the movie I feel like based on what I remember from the book kind of thing. So very interesting. And now Christmas on the Closed Ward.
serious being happy having the house full for Christmas.
Yes.
Having Harry there. And definitely a Christmas like none other for Harry. This is why this book hurts.
Yes, it does.
This is why this book hurts, man. And I, you know what? Even in the film, I think I remember actually, did I cry when I watched it the first time? I feel like I did. Because I think they did that part well for me back then. I can't remember how I feel when we watch it. Yep. But yep. Back then, I think at that moment, actually, yeah. Yeah. And now knowing these moments, remembering these moments. Yep.
Because they were not featured as much even in the movie. So,
you know,
it's cool. Yeah. But Snape does remind him he's not very useful because Snape says, so they're arguing, Snape and Sirius, at some point in this chapter when he's happy. Yeah. And Snape is like, I'm here on Dumbledore's orders. You know, I know you like to feel you're involved or whatever. And then he's like, what's that supposed to mean? That's Sirius to Snape. He's like, merely that I'm sure you must feel frustrated by the fact that you can do nothing useful. And that plants the seed for why Sirius ends up going. And it's just this spiral, like this relationship. And it's so cyclical. Like, if Harry had continued the hate into, like, that's why I kind of love fan fiction when they have the Slytherins and Gryffindors and everybody else getting along, because it's like they're breaking that chain of like hatred that has been going on forever.
Yes, yes.
Because it was perpetual. It was just going to go on and on and on and on and on. And this is the consequence. Partly serious. Anyway, we'll talk about it when we get to.
And what you're talking about, like, look where it even started when they were kids. And then into the adulthood where it actually caused deathly kind of consequences.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, definitely. And actually that Phineas line that I was talking about is in here. So whenever you're talking about your next point, I'll be finding it. Because I really find it very interesting what he says about the entitlement of young people in some ways. Because I think Harry is sort of like really worried. He's like, I want to leave.
I think I talk about a person not even reaching out when his dad got hurt.
That's
Percy is something else. That's why when we get to that, at the end of this book, he's still, does he come back home?
No, not at the end of this book. Oh, it's at the end of like book six?
Seven.
Yeah, seven. Into
seven,
six,
yeah.
Into seven. Yeah, yeah. He doesn't come back now.
Man,
I think it's not until the Battle of Hogwarts or something when they reconnect and then his brother. Yeah, yeah.
Seriously, Percy? I think I need to look at that picture again.
Believe me, when I tell you that reading, like I keep telling you, reading fan fiction really changes a lot about your mindset about characters, right? So it's like really heartbreaking when you see the actual canon character and you're like, damn, you could be this potential. And like I tell you, in A Measure of a Man, the other fan fiction that I kept going on about, which I'm still to finish because the writer has not like finished her last or second last update. So I just want to make sure I just end up reading it all in one go because it's so good.
So you understand what your readers feel like.
I was like, oh God, why did I?
But I'm not gonna. I've got two chapters to read and I'm looking forward to them.
Thank you. Just be happy about that for now. But in that story, Percy's so mature. He's like so like grounded, and you see the maturity from the Percy we knew in the books. The writer is able to bring that up a little bit and like sort of show you that he's gone through an evolution since then. He's not like less smarter. He's not less like knowledgeable, but he's chipped away at the other arrogance and the ego and the whatever he had before with the knowledge and stuff. That's what I appreciate about fan fiction. It allows us to keep living in this world in a way that allows us to redeem these characters. Because in some ways, Percy, I remember someone saying Percy could not have not done what he did because of the way apparently the way they perceived Miss Weasley loved her kids. She was sort of thinking that the person was positing that Miss Weasley kind of like is too overbearing or something, or she too.
And she is.
But I feel like it was a bit of a mean judgment call because I felt it was like, but the Weasleys are so loving though. Like, it's not like Percy came from Draco Malfoy's household where like his father was like pressure. So I feel like Percy was, his ambition came from the fact that they were poor. But as a result, he's like, I have to just prove you guys wrong. But he does it in the worst way possible, like shunning his family for their poverty and like lack of access and all of that stuff. Anyway, that's an interesting tangent we went on about Percy. But the point I was going to make was Harry, when he's spiraling, because obviously when he's spiraling, he wants to leave. And then he hears Phineas saying, like, Dumbledore said to stay where you are. And then Harry's, like, really angry, whatever, whatever, whatever. And then he's like, you know, this is precisely why I loathed being a teacher. Mind you, he became a headmaster, so he must have loved something about it. He's like a Snape, literally. Yeah. Young people are so infernally convinced that they're absolutely right about everything. Has it not occurred to you, my poor puffed up popinjay? That must be a British insult somewhere. That,
yeah.
Or I suppose it's a British term of whatever. That there might be an excellent reason why the headmaster of Hogwarts is not confiding every tiny detail of his plans to you. Have you never paused, while feeling hard done by, to note that following Dumbledore's orders has never led you into harm? No. Like all young people, you are quite sure that you alone feel and think. You alone recognize danger. You alone are the only one clever enough to realize what the Dark Lord may be planning. And then, like, you know, all of that stuff. But I don't know.
I feel like Snape, in a way, is not wrong.
No, it's Phineas, by the way. It's not Snape.
Oh, it's Phineas.
Harry's in his room and Phineas's portrait is in that room, and that's connected to Hogwarts.
But he's not
that's what I'm saying. That's why I like that, because at that point you're so for Harry, like, yeah, you know, Dumbledore sucks, Dumbledore this, but in some ways Dumbledore is acting like someone who's planning ahead. He's not just worried about Harry, and at this point he's still the puppet master. Harry's feelings don't really factor into it. It's what's the grand plan. So yeah, I just thought to highlight.
And I think Harry's reaction to everything would have been, as I said, and we'll keep on saying this point, that Harry's reaction would have been not so severe if he knew all these things. At the very least, I'm not saying Dumbledore should have told him what his plan A, B, C, D is, but at the very least, acknowledge what's happening to Harry.
Yeah.
That I've got a plan. We're going to do something about it. If I need your help or if I need you somewhere, you're definitely going to be, your input is definitely going to be needed.
Yeah.
But because all of this was happening, everything was amplified for Harry. And just, I've got a point later on where I'm like, Dumbledore, what were you thinking when we get to the
Occlumis? I think Dumbledore represents like a typical African parent, like tough love, keeping you out of the loop. Honestly, just grow up. We'll love you down the line, but just grow up for now. Like, it's crazy. But for me, I really loved as well Ginny in this chapter. Because this is the chapter where she calls out Harry. Because they're sitting down as a group and he's talking about, like, you guys have been looking at me funny or whatever, whatever. He's really feeling that hard done by attitude. Like, why are you guys not feeling what I'm feeling, kind of
angry Harry, yes.
Angry Harry. And then he's like, and then Ginny's like, well, we wanted to talk to you, but as you've been hiding ever since we got back. And then he's like, I didn't want anyone to talk to me. And then Ginny's like, well, that was stupid of you, seeing as you don't know anyone but me who's been possessed by you know who. And I can tell you how we feel.
That's why
I love the book, Ginny, because she's not afraid. Like, Hermione can hesitate.
What page is that on?
It is on page 441 on my edition of the book anyway, so I'm not sure if it is relatively the same for your book, but 441 thereabouts. But then it says, Harry remained quite still as the impact of these words hit him. Then he turned on the spot to face her. I forgot. And then Jenny's like, lucky you. I'm sorry, said Harry, and he meant it. So do you think I'm being possessed? And then she obviously goes through the criteria of what happens when she was possessed. And then she's like, well, I don't think you're being possessed because whatever, whatever. So there's little, that's why for me, when I keep going back to the shipping side of things, I'm like, I get why people want to ship Harry and Hermione because they've always been together. But I also understand why Ginny could work with Harry works with Harry because she has this extra quality that always puts him in his place to be like, why are you doing that? Why are you being an idiot? Why are you being...
Especially after she got over her crush and she could talk to him like a friend.
Yes, yes. And that's important for like a love interest because you can't just always be... Because sometimes Hermione is like that with Ron. She calls out Ron because it's easier for some reason for her to do that. Yeah. But with Harry, she calls him out, but she's also quite afraid of his anger. Like when he...
No, I feel like it's more like...
Not fear.
Yes, like, she does. I don't think she's afraid, but more like she's like a sibling. She kind of feels
Sorry, but you know what? You can... But I'm not trying to say I'm taking away the fact that they could be romantically interested in each other. But I'm saying that she's so cautious around him sometimes that it inevitably, even when she's saying, don't do it, Harry doesn't always pull back enough to be like, but Hermione is saying this at the moment. He then thinks about it later on, like, especially at the end. We'll see it at the end. Hermione definitely is like, no, this plan sucks. But in going along with it, anyway, it's a whole other thing. But I'm not trying
I can... Man, don't you dare ruin my crack shipping.
No, I'm not trying to ruin your crack shipping.
You are trying to ruin my crack shipping right now because I'm agreeing with you. And I see what you mean. And I can see how their relationship can be sibling-like.
Yep.
Yeah, I can definitely see how their relationship can be sibling-like.
Yeah.
Because I might say to my to a brother, to a sister, Kuti, what you're doing is not right, blah, blah, blah. What you want to do is not right. But if it's something that's not like that's not going to kill them or whatnot, and you still want to do it, I'll try and find a way for them to do it safely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And does Ron get Hermione perfume as a gift? I don't know why I wrote that point somewhere.
Does he?
I don't know. Does he? Because they wake up at Christmas morning, stack of presents. Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas.
If you're looking for that, at a point when you were talking about Snape telling Sirius to stay in the house and not to do anything, it's not just Snape who says it. The twins point it out too.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did have that point, and but so, I don't know why I had that point. Thank you for pointing that out. That's true. I don't know. I had a point that Hermione got something. Anyway, can't confirm it, but surely I must have come across it because why would I write that point? Like, why would I write that point if I didn't have anything on it? Whatever. The point being that by the end of this chapter, we've got Gilderoy Lockhart. We meet him and we meet Neville.
Yes, yes. I only wrote three words. Professor Lockhart, low.
literally. And then we meet Neville and we find out more about Neville and his history with his parents, and it's just so sad, and the way that Neville like still loves his parents pretty much, like, you know, he's still for his parents, which is like really, really good and just so sweet, but so sad because essentially like he got his childhood taken away from him. Him and Harry, that's why I love by the end when we learn that it could potentially have been Neville as well, Neville Longbottom and the Philosopher's Stone. But in the sense that
they live... His parents are dead in a way, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. That's what they live, literally a similar...
That's even worse. Like, he can see them,
But the only difference is Neville then grew up with the love of his extended family. Whereas Harry just, like, he just didn't.
Onto the occlumency lessons that Dumbledore was like, Harry needed to be taught by Snape. I don't know why I thought... Before all, it's speaking about the Snape element of it all, but I don't know why I thought the occlumency lessons happened in year six. Did he have occlumency with Snape again in year six?
Lessons in Dumbledore, but they were not occlumency related. That's when they do the prophecy stuff.
But again, said Dumbledore, Mr. Dumbledore, why? He knows their relationship, and I know he even explains it later on. I made a mistake getting Snape to teach you, but in what world, in all the 5 years, 4 years that Harry has been at Hogwarts, what made him think allowing Snape to teach Harry anything, especially that would make him so vulnerable, would be a good idea. But again, what is empty your mind? Snape, what do you mean by empty your mind? How the hell, sir, are you supposed to empty your mind?
It is.
Like, but in fan fiction, right, the occlumency classes are actually a turning point in Harry's relationship with Snape, especially if Snape is, like, in a position, in a father figure kind of role, or he adopts Harry. So the occlumency lessons in fanfic are actually a turning point for them. That but again, like, how does one empty their mind? There is no such thing. Unless you put your thoughts into a pensive.
Exactly. It's weird. He's got higher expectations for Harry. And I remember when you talked about how the documentary lessons with Snape being the turning point for like him and Harry in fan fiction. In fan fiction, Snape, I don't know if he's actually technically Harry, Malfoy's godfather in canon. I'm not sure. But he's sometimes portrayed.
Yes, he is. He is. Okay, cool. In canon, he is Harry.
Interesting.
Draco's godfather.
Okay, so yeah, he's Draco's godfather, but then he also teaches him occlumency around the time when, like, Voldemort is, like, pushing him to do the mission to kill Dumbledore. Uh-huh. So he starts, like, it's portrayed that, in fact, that Narcissa got him to help Draco. It actually kind of, even though in canon it's not portrayed that way, I don't think it is. We'll see in book six, but it makes sense, because I don't know how else Draco would have survived that without at least having something to shield his mind whilst he's trying to go through this lesson. So it's kind of interesting how Harry and Draco being like two sides of the same, I can't say two sides of the same coin, because they are vastly different. So
I don't know if that's
a correct term there, but it's interesting how he then comes in and like helps.
Maybe the events in there are even saying that.
Yeah, but they're boys who are put in tough situations.
Yes,
have meant to grow up really fast. And one is vilified for whatever they do, even though they had no choice. And the other is like hailed as a hero, even though he had no choice as well. He was chosen, but he didn't really have a choice. Like, you know, who wants to have Voldemort's half soul in his body? Like, nobody wants that. So it's very interesting. But I think for me, before we even get to necessarily the lesson starting, I think before that, we've got the parting of Harry and Sirius. And that is the last good moment they have in this book before the event at the end.
So this is
actually where, because I wrote down that there's a point when I think Sirius defends Harry, because Snape makes a reappearance, I think, at some point during one of the lessons. They see him. So, Snape does make a reappearance. And, you know, Sirius is, like, defending Harry as his godson. And then we've got a good moment, like, where Harry then has this bad feeling that this is, like, the last time they're going to meet or something. Like, not last time they're going to meet. It's, like, just something bad is going to happen. And he's really, like, sentimental or, like, the parting is like very bittersweet for him. He's not like happy to be seeing Sirius again because he feels this apprehension about what Sirius might do. And then Sirius gives him the gift.
I think I remember that because of everything that happened, the comments that have been made with you.
Yep.
You're not doing anything because you can't do anything, blah, blah, blah. And I think his mindset, Sirius, like it was even darker a little bit. It had moments where you'd be light when he was with Harry.
Pretty much.
But yeah.
And the two-way mirror. He gives him the two-way mirror, but then it's a bittersweet gift as well because Harry forgets about it. I mean, mind you, it's a plot convenience for JKR to allow the story to go on. But
I'm makes so sense upset because Harry was not thinking this year. That boy had one brain cell and that brain cell had split and it was wrapping them together, like, you know, just to create some sort of thought. Harry had no single thought in his mind that freaking year. That boy was not thinking.
Literally. It's really sad. Like, it just shows you that so much was working against their relationship to be a success. And not only relationship, like as in romantic, but their godfather-godson relationship, because Sirius was a wanted man.
I don't think you need to clarify that.
No. I'm just saying, like, you know, just clarifying for the sake of my head.
You've been reading too much Game of Thrones fanfiction, haven't you?
No, I don't. I'm not like you. I'm not a crack shipper. So, no.
I even regret even pointing that out. Let's just continue.
Okay. All right. You see, exactly. It's the pot calling the kettle black or something like that?
Excuse me. When I read Game of Thrones, I'm reading Brienne and Jaime. But again, let's just continue.
Okay.
You're right. No. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
I know. In the way you look at me, like, you know, you tend your head. And I'm like, oh, no, I actually know what she's about to say. So
I'm not saying it. I wasn't going to say it. But either way, I think when... It's so funny. You just make my life too much. Anyway, when we sort of see how he rediscovers the mirror, I think he rediscovers it in book 5 or at the end of, no, in book 6, I think, when he's packing his trunk or something.
Yes, yeah.
No. Oh, he does realize in this book, but then he realizes
in this book,
he should
at the
have
end
used,
when he's packing.
And then he cracks. Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Anyway, there's just like a, it's just so bittersweet. Like what I was saying, their relationship is doomed because Sirius is a wanted man. Even if he was, and the only way he could have been free would have been then the whole idea of the ministry being after him would have been usurped or whatever. But before that, he's also a wanted man in terms of the Death Eaters and Bellatrix and all that stuff. He's got a vendetta against him. Well, it's a target on his head, sorry. So there was just so much working against him. And then the order itself is undermining Sirius. They know what he's like, but then they... saying things and doing things that make him more aggravated, which is not smart. Like, you would think you'd keep him as satisfied as possible.
Yes, I understand their fault, but also the onus on the man. But
that's true.
You know what? He wasn't in a good place mentally.
That's true. He wasn't in a good place. He'd lost. He literally lost his best friends, went to jail, lived that nightmarish life, gets released, is expected to be a godfather to his godson. but in the worst possible way. Like, it's just not good. But either way, I just really enjoyed it. And then they went on the night bus again. We get a reintroduction. We get some Tonks and Remus, you know, featuring in there. I can't remember.
Yes, yes.
I think I said I get some satisfaction knowing Harry and Cho didn't really date because ultimately it was a crush. And I just laughed because I wanted to say it to you. Like, I just get so satisfied.
Excuse me,
the reason why I say that is I think something gets referenced here that, like,
you just want to trigger me, don't you?
I really, really do. So I was like just laughing, like, because something gets referenced and I was like, the ship of Cho and Harry. I can't help but.
But
I think obviously this is before they actually like officially break up, but they don't really date. They just go on the one date and then
I actually made a point to mention, like, when I was talking about the kiss and how Cho starts crying and how their relationship was doomed to fail, especially this year because Cho was grieving Cedric. I made a point to mention that, you know, it actually reminds me of my days when I was at Delena Shipper before I saw the lights, like how as soon as they got together on the other side we have Caroline and Stefan talking, Elena is sired to Damon, and then you have one scene where Elena is kissing Damon. It just makes it ugly.
It really,
like,
does.
There's no, you're like, so this character has no urgency. So in a way, is Damon kind of, is this another version of how Damon was with Caroline, like, you know, in the beginning? And so it just makes it ugly. And I'm like,
yeah,
no,
I remember that. That was so sad.
I'm like,
for the Delena ship, that was so sad for you guys. I was like. So sad, God.
Yeah,
but anyway, yeah. It is what it is. But I guess Harry finally gets the answer about the door because I think he sees it more in a vision. Apologies, God, my alarm again. But he sees it in a vision or something.
Mm.
I don't know. I wrote the point that for Harry finally gets a... For people who read the book, we're acting as if we didn't read the book, aren't we? Jesus Christ.
No. Do we need to actually say
we don't need to. We don't need to say anything. We don't need to give them the context. They just need to know that we read the book and we're just stumbling along because we forgot certain things. But if they want to know what happened, they can come on my computer and check the history of when the first part was recorded and the third part was recorded. And then, yeah, you know. But for now, it's just an inside joke. Nah, but I don't know if you had any more on that occlumency thing.
That's all I heard.
That's just this was like an introductory to occlumency, right? He actually then goes into Snape's head a bit later.
Yes. Cool. Yeah.
That's cool. And finally, we have Miss Hermione Granger devising a way to help a friend by bringing back in Rita Skeeter. Sorry, I saw the title of the chapter. It's called The Beetle at Bay. And I believe
this is when
Harry decides, no, Hermione decides to use the media to get people on side with Harry, which is quite smart of Miss Hermione. This is why I like Hermione.
Day, man. Exactly. She was Twitter.
Hermione's like, how can we use the mass media to get people to understand what you went through? So, because obviously this is off the back, to give some context, I guess, this is off the back of the mass breakout at Azkaban. So there's a reporting that Death Eaters, but obviously they're still framing it as Sirius Black being the leader.
I actually said the way the ministry was reaching for any reason not to connect the mass breakout from Azkaban to Lord Voldemort, like they found every other reason.
Yeah, literally. But being also serious, he's realizing that nobody really cares about Sirius being implicated in that. It's more they're just sort of like buzzing about. I think there's some conversations that the kids are starting to be smarter. They're not just like absorbing everything they're being told, it seems. Mm. I think I got that vibe. We get it more so when it comes to Umbridge and her dictatorship. But I noted that at page, there's a callback to, they then read about the guy who died with the plant.
Ah, yes.
They read about him. Yeah.
Board.
They read about him. So
Broderick Board.
Yes. So we get a sense of like things are really happening kind of thing. And then, I actually noted this down. So even though Umbridge and the ministry at large are like trying to undermine certain things, the students are definitely taking, there's a sense of agency with the kids, I'm guessing, from like what Harry is describing, what's going on. Like they're not just eating up everything that they're getting. And they're, in a way, being rebellious a little bit. So
the fact that also Harry reconciles with Seamus, because Seamus realizes that, you know, he'd been wrong from the beginning. Yeah.
Like the DA is the I guess what you call it, the vanguard or the leading whatevers. Ooh, of like
Vanguard. I like that. Yeah.
Because they are like, I mean, they are the ones that are going into lessons and being more rebellious or trying to do certain things that are a little bit different, which I enjoy because, man, Umbridge just makes life so... To think that... What's her name? I think her name is Imelda Staunton or something. She's like the sweetest lady. Mean in Harry Potter.
What is that? Pride and Prejudice. That Jane Austen...
Yeah, she's in Sense and Sensibility.
Sense and Sensibility. And she's this... I saw her the first time, I kind of flinched.
Literally, she is so sweet. Yeah. She is so sweet. And like, yeah, anyway, I can't wait to really see her embodied on the screen. But yeah, I like this line when he says, in their confusion and fear, these doubters now seem to be turning to the only other explanation available to them, the one that Harry and Dumbledore had been expounding since the previous year in terms of how the mass breakout from Azkaban was happening in the ministry. I mean, the prophet was reporting misinformation. It's really weird. This book is mirroring kind of what is happening right now with a lot of like spreading of misinformation and people wanting to know the source. Like, who do you turn to? Who do you look to? So just to contextualize, it's very interesting. It's a good book for if you're going to ever teach contextually about how misinformation and stuff happens. Book four is very good at that because it really shows how government agencies can use the media to spread lies and just like undermine people and whatever. Anyway, but that's being too political, but in the context of Harry Potter, they are being very, very shady. So yeah I just find that interesting. And the date happens because the date happens and then Harry goes and meets Hermione afterwards. So they break up off the fact that Harry goes, I need to meet Hermione. Do you want to come with me? But he's a little teenage boy. He doesn't understand how Cho would take that statement. Do you want to come and meet Hermione with me? And she's very mad and she walks away. And this is a prelude to him then preceding him going to see Hermione to do the interview. So this is the date chapter, which is very interesting.
What did I skip that? I don't even mention it. Was I too upset?
I don't know. Were you really that upset that they ended? Because, I mean...
No, but I feel like I documented somewhere because there was a funny scene between Hermione and Ron. Because Ron kept on focusing on... Ginny dating somebody.
No, that's at the end of this chapter. No, sorry, that's at the first DA chapter.
Yeah,
I think so.
So they go on a date after the failed kiss?
No. So the failed kiss happens at Christmas. This is now Valentine's Day. So they plan to meet on Valentine's. This is now Valentine's Day. So 2 months or so, or a month and a bit has passed, and now they go on their first official date. That's when Hermione says, we can meet with Rita Skeeter. She doesn't tell Harry at the time. So Harry, in the back of his mind, has this plan to then bring Cho along because he's thinking, you can just come along. It's Hermione. You know her. But Cho's already jealous. So that kind of sparks the, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And they go to like a really romantic place and Harry feels really awkward. So in some ways, self-sabotaged by Cho in terms of choosing that venue. But then what could she do? It's Valentine's Day. That's the best place to be, that particular cafe. But then also Harry
and Paris or something.
Yes, but then Harry then realizes Cho only really is interested mostly because of Cedric, because she starts asking questions about Cedric, and Harry's like, I would really love to forget about that. But that's the kind of point that they're making. So their short-lived romance was ultimately all about Cedric. That's what I said, and Harry laughs because he's realizing, what can he do? But then. You've got this perfect ending with like Hermione then taking the power back and sort of saying the world needs to know the truth. And even though they're using Luna Lovegood's dad's like paper, they're still finding a way to get the truth out there. So more power to Hermione for just really thinking on her feet and knowing how to get back at Rita Skeeter, because that's what shows you how perfect J.K. is as a writer, because the fact that she becomes a beetle might not make much sense in book four, but then it makes sense now when Hermione is literally blackmailing her.
Yes, yes.
Like,
and it's an interesting animagus form to have. Like, yes. What does it say about her character? Yeah, yeah.
It is so good. It is so, so good. I remember in one of the fan fictions that I was reading, I'm sure it's probably Measure of a Man, Hermione sort of like laughs with Harry about like Rita being a bug or whatever, and Draco's like, what do you mean? And then... Actually, no, he doesn't, because Draco knows about Rita Skeeter being a bug. But there's a reference, it's sort of like a callback to them all knowing about Rita Skeeter being a bug, and it's funny. But yeah, because Draco knows about Rita Skeeter being a bug, but he doesn't know that Hermione captured her, so that's a whole different thing. So wait, was there any other thing you wanted to make there? Were you looking for something, or?
I'm looking for this quote that I now know where I'm... Damn, I'm sorry, that's my chair.
No, that's okay, it wasn't that
audible. I was just looking for this quote, but I think this is when Dumbledore is escaping Umbridge and the Ministry officials.
Oh, okay.
When they come to arrest him. Yeah. Though I don't know what precedes that. Why do they come to arrest Dumbledore?
Well, you're now in the next chapter.
I have moved ahead.
I think you're definitely on the next chapter because, that's not happening until, another chapter after this. So right now in this particular chapter, we've got the lead up to that, I suppose. You've got Seamus coming back into the fold because the story gets released regarding that. And then Hermione shows sort of like how she understands women and all that stuff because she's helping them figure out something about whatever happened with Cho and the breakup. And then Ginny is also being mentioned a lot more and more in these chapters as well, in terms of like the twins sort of saying, oh, you know, come on, Ginny's not so bad. Actually, I don't know how she got so good, seeing how we never let her play with us, blah, blah, blah. That's a hint to do with Quidditch. So I think Ginny also tries out for Quidditch at some point during this book, does she? If I'm not mistaken.
I thought that was a previous book when arguing about...
But I think she does get...
Well, she wants to change her position.
Oh, okay, but so she is already playing, right?
Yeah, she's already playing because I remember in the previous book, or was it the book before when we went on about, you know, you saying
God.
If you had forgotten that part. I think she's already playing. I don't know if she's a reserve or whatnot, but because Harry is banned from Quidditch at this point in time.
Yes, because of the fight with Lizard King. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah. So we've got that. And then the twins keep dropping hints about them leaving. So we keep kind of getting that idea that the twins are thinking of getting out of Hogwarts. Hogwarts is not enough for them. And you've got the story, which is titled very, very well, Harry Potter Speaks Out at Last, The Truth About He Who Must Not Be Named and The Night I Saw Him Return. So you've just got this perfect balance of like people getting the truth, and then Umbridge trying to act against that by banning the Quibbler, but students being even more interested in reading it because the more you ban something, the more interested people become. And so kids devise ways. This is more of how the kids become rebellious. They devise ways to like read the Quibbler without Umbridge or the teachers knowing about it. Even the teachers, though, are reading the Quibbler too, and they're allowing the kids to read it. So this, I love the spirit of rebellion that's going on in Hogwarts. But I've talked a lot, man. Girl, talk.
I think I just skipped.
Oh, well.
Not skipped, but I think as I read, I was like, I don't really have anything to add to this.
I get you. I think that's probably my points on that, because I was just touching a lot on like the dynamics of what's going on in Hogwarts at the moment, like how people are now, you know, seeing Harry's point. And then I think that he does get another vision.
And this is why, and he goes to Dumbledore, and that's, and then that's when Umbridge and the Ministry comes in, right?
No, not yet. You're still a chapter before. So this chapter brings in Firenze as the... There's an introduction... Oh, this chapter is when... Yes, this is when Trelawney gets fired. And Dumbledore says, I only have the power to do that because I'm still the headmaster. You're just the High Inquisitor. And Umbridge starts calculating, how can I get this guy out? So this is what leads to Dumbledore ultimately. I mean, they're already planning to get him out, but this is like the perfect excuse for that. So Trelawney stays there, but Dumbledore then introduces Firenze. I don't know, I just have this like, Firenze, yes, I know he's a centaur, but he's described as just like a really attractive centaur. Like, listen to this whilst you're chuckling. Through the mist came a face Harry had seen once before on a dark, dangerous night in the Forbidden Forest. White blonde hair, not that I'm for the white blonde hair, but hello. And astonishingly blue eyes. The head and torso of a man joined the palomino body of a horse. This is Firenze said, blah, blah, blah. I'll find him. But then they describe him in the next chapter.
Yeah, can you read it to me?
Do you know why? No. Do you know why I find that their portrayal of that centaur peep type, whatever, is quote unquote attractive? It's not because of the way that he's even described in the book. It's because of my imagery of him from book one. Because in book one, they have you. Is he Bane or Firenze? He's Firenze. He's Firenze in book one, isn't he? Because Bane.
Yeah, it's Firenze.
Yeah, Firenze.
Because he lets Harry ride him. And since then, he's been kind of.
But they're portrayed as like these dark coloring type, obviously. Like,
yeah, that's what I thought. Because he's dark. He's actually dark. Dark skinned.
Yeah, I mean, they're like dark horse, like a black horse or a brown horse or whatever. I think that's the image I had. And that was like an attractive CGI looking thing that they did in the first book, which is so weird. Yeah, I was like too young to be thinking about that. But then I just found the idea of like the centaurs really attractive in the sense that they just have this higher sentient being thing with the stars and whatever. I don't know. I just found it very interesting how they're portrayed as being like close enough to humans. They are human beings. They're just human beings with like extra legs of like a horse, but like they are intelligent and they are independent of the world of the humans or whatever. I just find that very attractive. But then, like I said, the image of the centaur in book one is what spoiled my mind. So that's all I could picture when I was reading this book. I was like, damn it, Firenze from book one, from movie one.
I see.
Yes, damn it, Firenze from movie one. CGI abs, CGI everything. But this is the chapter you want, where Dumbledore escapes. But leading up to that, we've got the lessons of divination, whatever. And then the kids do their last forever doomed DA lesson. So
what lesson?
Okay, so what happens is Firenze comes in, he's teaching them, he's really good. They're all fascinated. Everybody's surprised that he knows Firenze as well. So that's another cool thing that makes Harry set apart from everybody. Because obviously he knows Firenze because, you know, Firenze helped him. Yeah. And then...
Guys, look at this tiny stinking nut.
Okay.
This was in the head at a normal distance, reading distance that she had to bring
it. What the hell? But then... So we actually got like the confirmation that Trelawney was just full of crap. She didn't know what she was doing. But I love this line. Ron is like, he's not very definite of anything, is he? Said Ron in a low voice as they put on their whatever, whatever. I mean, I could do with a few more details about this war we're about to have, couldn't you? And actually, he's predicting the war that's going to happen in this book. Ron is just making fun of the fact that he's still like at the end, but nothing is ever certain. Not even centaurs know anything, blah, 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 blah. And Ron is like, can you just make people sure? But now we then get the scene of the DA having their last lesson. And what I said was, I actually remembered this scene very differently because, if I'm not mistaken, in the movie, it's like they are able to somehow break through the room of requirements, which is terrible mythology.
Dumbledore.
But that's not what happens. Dobby is actually the person who comes and warns them, because technically you're not supposed to find a room of requirement if you don't know what to say about it. Like, it doesn't make sense. It really, really doesn't. Yes, the person who's what's her name, Mariella?
But they couldn't, because of the protection charm.
Yes,
she couldn't actually help them find where
the room was. Exactly. Yeah. But they knew that it was on the seventh level, whatever. That's true. But then Dobby's actually the one that comes in and warns them that they're coming, and what is it called? So he comes in, and then Harry's the one that gets caught. He gets dragged to Dumbledore's office, but Dumbledore's always two steps ahead.
Before you go on to that, the fact that, again, Dobby was removed, like they didn't give Dobby his time with Harry, all these little moments that Dobby is involved in Harry's life, the then moment where he sacrificed, where he helps Harry in book seven, and then he dies, it just makes it more, even more like, you know, profound.
Literally. Imagine, for most of this, I was just skipping the parts where Malfoy does anything. I just was like, no, Malfoy, that's not you. That's not you.
Sorry, what? That's not him?
No. This was another twin Malfoy in an alternate universe. You become a better man.
Damn. Kumba.
But either way,
the love for him is so real, huh?
I'm a stand for Malfoy. It didn't even make it better. When we talk about the, have you watched yet the Return to Hogwarts?
I started because we're going to talk about it, but then
we'll talk. We'll talk about stuff, it.
And then I'm like, I'll watch it. We'll talk about it. We'll
talk about it. My love just knows no bounds now. But either way, so you're getting to your favorite part, which you can start talking about, which is when the ministry captures or comes in to try to say, we've got you now, Dumbledore. But like I said, Dumbledore is two steps ahead. It's also the first time that Dumbledore and Harry have like an interaction properly. Because if I'm not mistaken, you laughing at my sticky notes again, in the moment when Marietta whatever gets captured, Dumbledore obviously claims that he's the leader of the army, and he's like just laughing away saying, you're never going to capture me. And they're arrogant, thinking they're going to capture him because they've got two auras. But little did they know that one of the auras is on Dumbledore's side.
Yes.
So he's already got that covered. And he's already got his phoenix there ready to, like, whisk him away or whatever. So I just found it.
That's said in the movie. Like, damn!
But also, the movie makes it so dramatic that you miss that Harry and Dumbledore actually have an interaction. Dumbledore makes them all kind of, like, fall, whatever, disorients the scene, makes everything blow up. But then he actually talks to Harry and he says, funny enough, one of the headmasters is like defending.
It is Marietta.
Yes, Marietta. One of the when they are being accused, when he's being accused, one of the headmasters is like, blatant corruption, wrote the portrait of the whatever wizard. The ministry did not cut deals with petty criminals in my day. No, sir, they did not, whatever. And like Dumbledore is like, thank you very much, headmaster, whoever. Because they're all for him. They're all for him. I just love those little moments. I don't know. Like, I'm like, if we could get 10 hours of Order of the Phoenix, I would be so happy just to see it all unfolding. But obviously, that's not going to be the case.
The moment that you're after is on page 548 on my, towards the end.
Oh, okay, cool. Thank you.
Listen to me, Harry.
Yes. So that interaction happens. I don't really want to read it. I just sort of wanted to highlight that they literally have an interaction and there's that thing of he wants to strike Dumbledore again. Yeah. But no, but this thing, he also wants to strike Dumbledore. He still has that Voldemort controlling thing.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, so he says, remember, close your mind. And then, but as Dumbledore's fingers closed over Harry's skin, a pain shot through Harry's kababa, and he felt again the terrible snake-like longing to strike Dumbledore, to bite him, to hurt him, because Voldemort is technically seeing through Harry's eyes. And then Dumbledore whispered, you understand. Oh, God. And folks went away and took Dumbledore and blah.
Man, that scene, you know what, sometimes the
visualization of it,
they get it right.
Yes, they
get it right sometimes. Yeah, like, that scene was epic in the movie. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Definitely. But, I mean, in the trailer, remember, it would just be like that snapping that he does. And then he joins his hands at the top and he just...
Both hands in the air.
And then Kingsley Shacklebolt with the style line. I think he actually says that. Yes. Let me double check. So,
what I wanted to talk about this chapter was when Fudge is saying, we've now got you, take him away to the auras that he's with. So he says to Dumbledore, you will now be escorted back to the ministry where you will be formally charged, then sent to Azkaban to await trial. Dumbledore's like, said Dumbledore gently. Yes, I thought we might hit a little snag. Snag, said Fudge, his voice still vibrating with joy. I see no snag, Dumbledore. Well, said Dumbledore apologetically, I'm afraid I do, or really. Then my favorite line, well, it's just that you seem to be laboring under the delusion that I'm going to, what is the phrase? Come quietly.
Yeah.
The part where he says laboring under the delusion.
Oh my God. He is just too good. He's too good.
I have absolutely no intention of being sent to Azkaban. I could break out, of course, but what a waste of time. Like, damn. Like, I hesitate to say big, energy, but that is big energy.
Exactly. I mean, he just knows his stuff, man. He's so confident. He's so self-assured. He just knows he's got a plan and it's going to work out and he's confident in that plan. And even if it doesn't work out, he's got a backup to the backup to the backup. Yeah, like, you know, he's just so good.
And the fact that he can break out of Azkaban, and I can very well believe it. Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. So I don't know about you, but because, we just did like a little silent introduction there that we're expecting. But I think that concludes.
I'm recovering from COVID. My throat now hurts a little bit.
I can imagine, girl. I can imagine. I know the life. It took me a good month to feel like I had my throat back again. I was like,